Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to the world's longest running football fans podcast from CelticUnderground.net.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed.
Well, Sunday was a bit rubbish, wasn't it? In fact, in some ways, I was even more agitated by Sunday than I was the week before. With the IGA performance that we put in that, at least this one, anyway, I'm not going to go on about it. It happened. Hopefully we beat Hearts on Saturday and clinch the trophy. Talking of beating Hearts, this week's guest on the podcast gives us a bit of an insight into a very interesting period where Celtic pip Hearts. It's author of Heartbreakers, Mr. Stephen McGowan, chief sports writer of the Daily Mail, where he gives us a review of his online book about the 1986 championship winning team who pipped Hearts on the very last day of the season and went on to lift the league championship. Stephen was at Celtic during the time of, at the Celtic View rather, during the time of Fergus, Wim Janssen and the transfer over to Venglos and then John Barnes. So he gives us an excellent insight into that and then finishes off with an up-to-date review of the current situation in relation to the Celtic manager. So, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Stephen McGowan. I'm joined by Stephen McGowan, chief football writer at the Daily Mail. Stephen, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks.
So before we get going with the podcast, there's two questions we always ask first-time guests. What was your first game and who was your first hero?
My first game, I was living, I went to primary school in Dunfermline. I was from Glasgow, but I went to primary school in Dunfermline. And I would go with an old pal and we would go to East End Park and get in for the last 20 minutes. We would go in free. I don't know the exact first, I remember being at a promotion game against Falkirk. It was a decent crowd, but the most vivid memory I have, early football memory, is an incident which was notorious at the time, where a guy called John Pelosi crashed into an Dunfermline defender called Jim Brown. And it was such a bad tackle, it became a civil prosecution, as I remember. And I still remember the scream of Jim Brown screaming, "Yabee." Can I say that?
You can say the full word, it just means I have to put explicit on the podcast.
Well, okay. Yabee, okay, we'll just say Yabee. Screaming it across the air in Fife, and I always remember that. And yeah, I remembered as well, my uncle was the janitor of Dalmarnock Primary School. And when we went to visit them, my brother would take me along for the last 20 minutes of Celtic games as well. We used to open the gates.
We opened the gates, yeah.
Yeah, we opened the gates and we'd go in there. And I remember a 4-1 win against St Mirren, Frank McGarvey scoring that as well. So it was all kind of cheapskate memories. Football memories we didn't actually have to pay for.
In Dunfermline time, that would have been when they were in like the second or third tier.
They were a terrible state at the time. I mean, it was amazing because they were, I mean, they've been in a bad state recently. But yeah, they were fourth bottom of Division 2. A guy called Jim Melrose was the manager. And your heroes, such as they were guys who no one would have heard of, like Sandy McNaughton and Mike Leonard and John Sultan, and you know, it was football in the raw. It was football with no glamour attached. But you know, that was the reality of it. You know, we tend to remember now the Aberdeen, Dundee United, the New Firm, and Celtic being a good team at the time, and the Hearts as well coming on 85-86, but I think it's kind of sepia tinge because even in the early 80s and the kind of halcyon days, inverted commas, Scottish football still had some pretty low crowds and some pretty...
St Anthony and our side stuck up a thing. Now, the point I always make to people is Celtic's average attendance in around about 80, 81, 82
absolutely
was 16 and 18,000. Yeah. A big crowd would be when we played Hibs or Aberdeen
or Dundee United at Hearts, and it'd be
39,000. It was always 39,000. And you know, I think everybody can remember games Celtic Park where there was easily 60,000 people in there, and it would come out as 39,000.
But St Anthony posted a report on Celtic beat Dundee 1984, 4,000, I think it was 4,956 people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but that's the thing about the whole 60,000 thing. You know, people now talk Celtic Park 60,000. That was the exception rather than the rule, I would argue. You know, yeah. I mean, I think the Lisbon Lions, I remember speaking to, I think it was Ronnie Cully, used to be with the Evening Times, and he made the point that Hugh McDonald, even when the Lisbon Lions were in their prime, crowd average is probably 32,000.
Yeah.
You know, when you're the best team in Europe. So 60,000 was actually a fairly exceptional period.
Yeah, joke with people. Do you remember those halcyon days when your stadiums were sold out and there was 60,000 in Celtic Park? Yeah, it was about 5 years ago. You know, so that was your time. Who was your first hero?
Well, as I say, I met the guy. My first football stop was at Inferno stop. An old Buckton number guy called Sandy McNaughton was at Inferno centre forward. Kenny Dalglish, obviously. I liked Ronnie Glavin as well, funny enough.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of Ronnie Glavin's long range shots. But
my brother was at the Barnsley Johnson's Paint Cup final the other week because he was a Ronnie Glavin
Barnsley
fan.
Legend, Ronnie Glavin,
then followed Ronnie Glavin down to Barnsley.
I couldn't tell you anything about him now, other than having a vague recollection of, you know, kind of Glavin, Dalglish, and a couple of Inferno players as well. You know, oh gosh, Dalglish is an easy one, isn't it? You know, I mean, you can't get past him. You know, in those days, you give your age away when you actually played football with your pal on the street. And Gordon Strachan makes this point, and it's something that's been lost to kids in Scotland. You imagined being your idol.
Mm-hmm.
You went out in the street, you kicked a ball about with no ball game signs, and you imagined being your idol. And I don't know if kids have that any longer. I don't know if they still experience that.
I don't think they do. I mean, you know, you're showing your age there. The thing I always remember about playing in the street, guy who used to live next door to us, I always remember once giving my age away.
Yeah.
It was a Saturday night, and the three of us, me and my two brothers, were out playing the street with him, and he was about to go out for a night on the town, and my mum and dad came out, and he didn't want them to see him smoking. And he stood his cigarette up in the heel of his high-heeled boots, his big platform boots, and the whole cigarette stood up. So that's given me my age away. But they wear strips. They wear Man City strips and Barcelona strips.
Well, that's the thing, yeah. That's a very good point. You know, I mean, there was a time. Actually, Archie McPherson, whose son is a big Hibs fan, made this point to me once. I did a piece of him. He said, it used to be a time you drove down Easter Road, leaf for a community area like that, you would only see Hibs strips. Now you don't see any Hibs strips. Now you see Barcelona or Real Madrid or Manchester United or Chelsea. And I think the striking thing for me was when there was a story recently there that Barcelona strip sells more in Glasgow than Celtic or Rangers, which is an incredible state of affairs.
I think there's a couple of reasons for it. I think one is the media coverage of that.
Yeah.
I think also, I mean, I've only got a six-year-old, so he's not quite at this stage yet in terms of school comments, but certainly I remember he's hearing it with my nephew. My nephew could turn up to school for PE wearing a Barcelona strip or a Man City, a Man U strip, but he wouldn't be allowed to wear a Celtic or a Rangers strip.
Yeah.
And I always found it a bit odd that
a Catholic school
in Glasgow wouldn't let someone wear a Celtic strip in case it caused problems, but that...
Yeah, that was the case now. And I remember when I did Andy Ritchie's book. I mean, it's obviously amazing story about the year when he was Scotland's player of the year 1979, and he went down to Greenock. He didn't live in Greenock, he was from Belsall, Andy, but he's Scotland's player of the year. He's a name in everybody's life. He's opening up Billy Smart Circus at Kelvin Hall, you know, he's he's throwing darts for charity and telly and things. And he went to park his car outside a primary school in Greenock with his wife, and he gets out of the car and he hears a kid playing football screaming, "And Richie scores!" And he thought that was the most bizarre experience. But you wouldn't get that now.
No.
You just wouldn't get it now, because I just think we've lost the whole concept of Scottish kids having Scottish idols.
And a lack of attachment.
Yeah, because a generation's been lost. You've got a generation who have grown to almost kind of treat Scottish football as a lower class pursuit, because that's the way television treats it.
Mm-hmm.
And they've never seen the Scotland national team at a major international finals. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm an age now, not so much 74, but I mean 74, 78, 82, 86, 1990. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was the norm. Mm-hmm. You just took it for granted. And actually, the gripes used to be, that we never got to the second stage.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine griping about that now?
Yeah.
You'd just be delighted to be there.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's where we're at.
Well, getting into the 80s period of football, the reason for having you on the podcast is you've written a book about one of the most famous Celtic League wins in history, and certainly one of the great ones in my lifetime, which was 86.
Yeah.
What made you decide to write it?
I was at the game. My brother was a student at Paisley Tech at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to go down and visit him periodically.
About a million people were at the game from social media now.
There was only actually 17,000.
There's a million people at the game.
Oh, everybody was at that game that day. There's always my brother was at Paisley Tech and I went down to visit. I remember taking a football special. And I remember buying a ticket in the queue and standing there, and there was a guy in front of me came back to his mates and he had a betting slip. And the betting slip said Celtic to win 4-0 and indeed to beat Hearts 2-0.
Mm-hmm.
And his friends just laughed at him and said, "Don't be ridiculous. What a preposterous scenario. Who are you kidding? You're like, God loves an optimist." And I always think about that guy sitting that night thinking, I was too conservative.
Yeah,
I wish I'd gone another goal. Oh, and I think, you know, it's a win-win because, you know, obviously the way things worked out, it was a remarkable day. And it was the first for me, I mean, for a lot of last day scenarios recently, you know, you've got, obviously, there's been a number of Scottish football. Back to Kilmarnock pipping Hearts in 65.
Yeah.
Back to Rangers beating Celtic 79. You've got 86. You've got a number in the noughties, you know, with Celtic in the last day 2003, Seville team. Being beaten at Rugby Park when Rangers beat Dunfermline. The Chris Sutton comments, you've got 2005, Scott McDonald, you've got 2008 when Celtic did it at Tannadice in the final day.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I think you relate to football more when you were a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, being a teenager, that 86 was so remarkable in so many ways, so many things that happened. You've got Craig Levein falling out for Hearts.
Mm-hmm.
That was a kind of impregnable central defence for Hearts. Sandy Jard and Craig Levein. Fell ill, they'd had the same team all season. Falls ill the day before with a virus, so he's missing. They bring in Roddy McDonald. St Mirren's goalkeeper falls ill an hour before kickoff at Love Street.
I've got a colleague who's a Hearts fan who's very dubious about whether he did fall ill.
Well, Jim Stewart's up in the stand and he's eating a pie. And he's a backup keeper and he's told, "Right, you better get down." So he goes down to the dressing room.
Was it Billy Thompson that was...
I think it was Campbell Money. And Jim Stewart gets a call, he's eating a pie and he goes down, he gets himself changed. And then Jim Stewart vomits in the dressing room. And they're like, they're basically two goalkeepers in a bad way before getting out there. He wasn't really to blame for it. And then, of course, Hearts have a huge penalty claim in the fourth minute of the game. But you have this incredible scenario in Scottish football where the Hearts supporter refereeing the game, a guy called Bill Crombie from Edinburgh, felt he couldn't give Hearts a penalty in the fourth minute. Now, whether that was because it was a blatant penalty.
Well, I've seen it since I've heard Hearts fans talking about that. I've then watched it.
Colin Henry chops down Sandy Clark. It's a penalty. And a guy called George Smith was supposed to be the referee.
Mm-hmm.
And he was offered the chance to go and referee the under-19 championships. In Malta, I think it was. And the SFA offered him that and he says, "Well, okay, thanks very much." So they have to call in another referee. So they go to Bill Crombie, the only one he can get. Hearts fan from Edinburgh. Various stories revolve around this. Where John Robertson, the Hearts striker, said to me that Bill Crombie told people in his work the day before he wouldn't be giving anyone a penalty. But referees have always had this thing, haven't they? They don't want to give early penalties.
Yeah.
You know, whether a penalty is happens in the second minute or the 88th minute, I don't think it matters. It's a penalty, it's a penalty.
But I think right at the beginning of the game and right at the very end of a game, because they're the most two controversial games.
But only in Scotland could you have a scenario where a Hearts supporter could be appointed to the most important Hearts game in 26 years and not want to give his team a penalty. It was almost inverse favouritism, where he didn't, rather than favouring his team. I mean, can you imagine social media? If social media had existed in those days, and word had got out that Hearts fan was in charge of the biggest Hearts game in 3 decades, it would have been incredible. But nobody really knew at that time. Comes in, doesn't want to give his team a penalty.
I can understand that rationale.
Yeah.
You're either going to go one of two ways. You're either going to... You just can't help yourself and you just pointed to the spot before you've had time to think about it because you're such a fan. Or you're going to think, you're going to pause for a second. I once worked with a guy who's a referee who said, the minute you pause, you don't give it.
Yeah.
Because you immediately then start to think, why have I paused?
Well, it was amazing lack of protest from the Hearts players. And they get to 0-0, they get to half-time and it's 0-0, they're 0-0. Celtic, and word gets out in dribs and drabs, Celtic are 4-0 up at Love Street. Mm-hmm. And Henry Smith's walking off the pitch and he can sense the fans are a bit edgy. And a photographer shouts to him, big man, Celtic are 4-0 up. And Henry Smith says to him, oh, bollocks, nonsense. He says, no, they are. He goes, all right, okay, right. And he goes in. And various Hearts people say they didn't know the score. Either way, Ali McDonald, the manager, had asked his chief scout, I think Ian Cruikshank, his name was, to keep him posted. He was at Love Street. Mm-hmm. Had asked him to keep him posted of Celtic goals, but hadn't done so. He didn't see the point. Well, what good did it do Hearts to know Celtic were 4-0 up? But they did, and they got nervous at half time. And on the Dens Park in those days, there was an old clock in the corner, and it told you the time. Henry Smith will tell you about seeing the clock, and it just seemed to tick interminably in the second half until this point where Albert Kidd comes on with half an hour to go.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people think he came on and scored two goals straight away. He didn't actually. He came on as a substitute for Tosh McKinley in the 61st minute. But he changed the game. And there was a guy, Vince Menny of Dundee, absolute haddie, who was supposed to be this technical, he was first Scot to play in the Bundesliga.
Right.
And he came over from Cologne and he put his sign for Dundee, and I thought they'd signed a great player. And he had a great effort on goal. It was Henry Smith, leaps down, pushes round the post. And Hearts are getting deeper and mm-hmm. deeper and deeper. And then, you know, they lose their first goal from a corner all season. Bobby Connor puts the ball in. Henry Smith comes out, goes for it, misses it. Albert Kidd puts it in the top corner, and that's it. He's gone. In an instant, he's gone. And Celtic have won it.
And it was an odd season because actually there's a wee bit about Davy Hay that I always have been thinking about with Ronnie Dyler this season.
Yeah.
Because the thing I remember was football people saying, Celtic fans starting to phone in and starting to get on Davy Hayes' back.
Yeah.
Because we were used to winning, and the only challenge come from, for what was it, 7-8 years, the only challenge had come from Aberdeen and Dundee United, and we had Hearts now. Where have Hearts come from?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the expectation always was that the main challenge that season would come from East Coast, but from Dundee and Aberdeen, not from Edinburgh. And in actual fact, if you look at it, it was remarkable because Celtic were fourth for most of the season.
Mm-hmm.
Scotland had a World Cup playoff in Australia in November, December 1985. And the clubs who contributed the most players, Aberdeen, Celtic, so on, had a couple of games off. You know, it was a recognition that Scotland players had to be afforded rest before they flew to Australia to get Scotland to World Cup finals. But Hearts kept playing and Hearts kept winning. And the month before, Celtic had a terrible time of it. They had played against Aberdeen, lost 4-1 at Pittodrie, Davy Provan's last goal. They had gone to Ibrox for Mark McGee's debut and lost 3-0. They had gone to Tannadice and lost 3-0 as well. They'd played the three major, well, not Rangers weren't the major rival at that time, but they'd played three of the top teams in the league and they'd lost 10 goals in three games. And the wheels were beginning to fall off. It's slightly after the Atletico Madrid behind closed doors game.
Right, yeah.
Where that really seemed to knock the wind out.
Uh-huh.
They lost 2-1 and there was no crowd.
Yeah, because we got the result away from home.
Yeah, 1-1, Mo Johnson scored the header. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah. I'm becoming mellow in my old days. I don't love them anymore.
Yeah, so Mo Johnson scores over in Madrid and then they lose 2-1 at home in this funereal atmosphere. And the wheels fall off a little bit. And they've this terrible November. And they've also lost 4 goals in the League Cup against High Hibs. So they had the poorest defence. Didn't really have a left back much in that season. They had like Tommy Burns playing the first day of the season at Tynecastle. Mm-hmm. Where they drew 1-1 with Hearts, which became a big, big game because Celtic equalised in the last minute. That point was as valuable as what happened at the end.
Because it was only 2 points for a win. For
Of course, aye. And so they had a terrible November. Hearts take advantage, go to Ibrox on December 28th and win 2-0 on a nice, icy pitch. And that night, Alan McDonald went into the dressing room and said to the Hearts players, he said, right, we're going to be champions. This is going to be Hearts' year. But he never ever said it publicly. because they never ever do. But yeah, privately, Hearts were having this conviction on their way to winning 20, they had been unbeaten in 27 league games, that they were going to do it. I don't think anyone ever felt the same about Celtic. You know, they always had games in hand, they always had the chance, but Hearts had the points in the bag, Celtic didn't. And even at the beginning of 1986, they were a bit hit and miss. And as you quite rightly say, they were unconvincing. Davey Hay, actually, for all his images, a nice guy, fired Frank Corner in January 86, and then did it all himself. And it actually seemed to improve things slightly, as if maybe the balance of the backroom team just hadn't quite been right. Yeah. And you can't imagine now a manager taking on all the coaching duties himself.
No.
Other than having Bobby Lennox as reserve coach. It would be unthinkable, and he did it, and, you know, he pulled things around. And it all turned around, really, with the 4-4 draw at Ibrox against Rangers.
Which was quite a remarkable game, that.
It 4-4, was, yeah.
Because we were up, and then he got it to 4-3.
Well, Celtic were 2-0 up early doors. McClure and Johnson scored, and Willie McStay got sent off after 35 minutes. And Willie was pitched in at right back that day against Ted McMinn. And Davey Hay told me that he thought about taking him off after 15 minutes because it was obvious the rain was pouring down. McMinn was just in one of those days that McMinn could have. And he thought about taking him off, but he decided against it when he got booked. And sure enough, Willie brings into an unwise tackle on Ted McMinn in the right back. It's a situation, and he has to go. So Celtic are down to 10 men. And Rangers pull one back. But even then, it's not disastrous, because I think Tommy Burns scores at the beginning of the second half and it goes to 3-1. Puts one in the low into the corner.
Yep.
And then Rangers turn it around. I think I remember Cammy Fraser scoring.
Yeah.
And Rangers go to 4-3, and Ibrox is absolute bedlam. And you're thinking, well, this could be a finisher for Celtic, because up and down season, 4-3 down to Rangers, and then Murdo McLeod pings one in the top corner from 25 yards, as Murdo McLeod was wont to do. And I think if you speak to key figures involved, they'll tell you that that was a big morale boost, because in a funny sort of way, even though Celtic had led twice, because they got the point in a situation of adversity with 10 men at Ibrox, they actually felt it was a bit of a moral victory. And from then on, they didn't really look back.
But just what you mentioned there as well, the players in the squad, although he was coming to the end of his career, you had McGrain, you had Aitken, you had McStay, you had McLeod, you had Johnson, McClare,
really
McGee. McGee couldn't get in the team, who had been the guy who was one of the main reasons that Aberdeen had been winning trophies just 2 or 3 years earlier. Actually, the squad.
But McGrain missed quite a few games that season with injury, and then sometimes filled in at left back. And Davey Hay made a big call round about February before a game against Hearts at Celtic Park, who obviously by then were the main challengers.
Yeah.
And he took Derry White aside at Seamill the night before. Derry White was 17. He'd been disappointed because he hadn't got in for a Queen's Park Scottish Cup game the week before. And he took him aside and said, right, you're starting tomorrow at left back. 17 against your main rivals before a big crowd, biggest crowd in Britain that day. And Derry White went in and again really excelled and became the new Celtic left back. But the odd thing was that Derry White thought of himself as a centre back. He never regarded himself as a left back. He'd never been a left back. But that's where it was. I mean, Davey Hay had obviously wanted to try and go and get Pat Nevin and Joe McLaughlin and Stevie Clark and had been denied the funds to do it. So he was patching things up all of the time. So you had Derek White at left back. David Provan had fallen ill, of course.
That's right.
Made his last appearance as a sub against Motherwell, I think, in January 86. So he was out. So you guys like Owen Archdeacon coming in. So they were patching up all the time. But you're right, the core of the squad was excellent. And you had guys who were proven winners as well. Guys who'd been over the course, like Aitken, McGrain, McStay, Burns. Proven had been until they fell ill. Pat Bonner as well. So, you know, if push comes to shove, I think probably that was the edge they had over Hearts. They really knew how to get over the line and how to get it done, which was reflected when they won the last 8 games and really put the pressure on.
There's also something missing about that season, because was there not a big chunk of it that there was no TV coverage of it as well?
That might well be.
I can remember, I mean, again, people will find it. I can remember playing Hearts at Celtic Park, and Hearts had the whole of the Rangers end.
Yeah.
And they filled it.
Yeah.
And it was, in fact, I think that might have been the first game that was on the telly after the blackout.
It did feature, though, it was the first ever Scottish live televised league game happened that season.
Yeah.
It was Hearts against Aberdeen at Tynecastle. That was three games from the end. And that was the first time nerves really began to set in for Hearts. They'd gone to Tannadice and beaten the United 3-0 in April 12th. And that was the night, I think, Sportsman was certainly on that night, because I remember sitting watching it at my grand's house and going, crikey, Hearts are going to win the league. It was a bit like Leicester last night, actually. Mm-hmm. That really defining moment where you think, they're not going to crack here, they're going to do this. John Robertson pings one into the top corner from 25 yards. Henry Smith pulls off a save of his life. Robertson scores another one. And you're thinking, they've just beaten Dundee United, who at the time were their main challenge. They were second in the United. They've got up being thrashed on 3-0. And they're going to win the league. But then, the nerves, you're just a bit of a jangle in the day. They get a 1-1 draw against Aberdeen in that first live televised game. Aberdeen get a dodgy penalty. Hearts scrape a draw with a late Colquhoun goal. They play Clyde Banks second game for the end. 1-0. Nerves really setting in. Gary Mackay scores. But they still just need a point in the final game. And if Celtic had two games left, they went to Fir Park Motherwell on the Wednesday night. And if they dropped anything there, Hearts were the champions. Mm-hmm. They won 2-0. Brian McQuarrie scores twice. And then it all comes down to the final day. And it's who holds on their best.
And Celtic score the best goal I've ever seen Celtic score.
Yeah, but St Mirren actually, and it's interesting, there's a chapter on St Lydon, because as Hugh Keevans put it to me, and after mentioning Mo Johnson, I'm pushing it now, mentioning Hugh, but as Hugh Keevans put it, it's almost the first conspiracy theory in Scottish football about St Mirren lying down that day. St Lydon, as Scott Wilson, the Hearts match day announcer, still calls them. Because that disappointment does strange things to people. I mean, Hearts had it all in their own hands, and John Robertson will tell you that. They only had to get a point. They can't blame anyone else. Mm-hmm. But they still have this theory that Frank McGarvey and other Celtic fans in the St Mirren team, like Tony Fitzpatrick, I think Peter Mackey played for Celtic as a kid as well, way down to Celtic that day. But if you speak to Frank McGarvey, he'll tell you that he's been wronged here, because actually he put through Peter Mackey for two very early chances. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The two really good chances, and he blew both of them. And then Brian McQuarrie scores up a header, and Celtic move up the gears. And as you quite rightly say, the third goal, I think, was the best goal you've seen from a Celtic team in the modern era.
And the thing about that third goal, getting back to McGarvey playing a through ball, it was actually a ball that was going to land in the Celtic box. Danny McGrain just hooks it over his shoulder.
One of the most
to clear it.
Well, I would urge anybody who's never seen that, well, everybody's seen that goal probably, but anyone who has, to go back and watch it again, as I've done a number of times for the book, and it's just the most audacious pass you'll ever see. Danny McGrain, on the edge of his own 18-yard line, hooks the ball over his own head to Roy Aitken, you know, and then the move starts. And it's a dazzling tempo and pace and a brilliant goal.
And actually, that period, that trophy win, marks a complete transformation in Scottish football for the next nearly 30 years.
Yeah, well, I mean, that football special came off. I talked about it earlier. He came off at Central Station again. And got off a train. I remember two little old guys in Rangers scarf standing in a train, platform 11 or whatever it was, of course, you know, kind of like saying, right, let's go and get them. And everybody's laughed at them. Because Rangers had won 2-0 that day against Motherwell at Ibrox. Mm-hmm. And they did that to clinch the final UEFA Cup place. Mm-hmm. As soon as it just kicked off. And so I think Souness's first game was a defeat to Clyde Bank, if my memory serves. But, you know, they won 2-0. They got to the UEFA Cup at Dundee's expense, actually, even though Dundee had won. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody quite realised just how much things were going to change.
Because I remember, was it shortly after, it was a Glasgow Cup final at Ibrox between Celtic and Rangers. And they filled the place. Mm. And we were laughing at them.
Yeah.
Because we were champions.
Well, there was a very sniffy attitude amongst the Celtic directors towards that whole thing. I mean, I remember, I think there was a reference. One Celtic director referred to him as the Marlborough Watts team. It was Lawrence Marlborough was the major shareholder.
Yeah, right.
The Marlborough Watts team. And it was almost a kind of haughty, kind of, you know, you can't buy success type attitude. You know, we'll keep sticking to our principles. We're Celtic, we'll do this, we'll do that. And you could buy success. Because Graham Souness has proved it.
Yeah.
You know, irrespective of the means, fair or foul, and in those days were fair, but they went and got some of the best players in Britain. They took ruthless advantage of the English clubs being out of Europe. Mm-hmm. You might get Terry Butcher, you've got Chris Woods, send some of the best players in England. And meanwhile, Celtic sat back and said, you know. And actually, the next season, Celtic were in the pole position to win the league again.
Yeah.
At Christmas, we're sitting, I think it was 9 or 10 a.m.
Uh-huh.
and then it all falls apart. And Davey Hay takes it to the final day again. And again, Albert Kidd comes on as a substitute for Falkirk at Celtic Park this time. But there's only 14,000 people there, and Celtic was 2-1 to Falkirk. Jimmy Gilmore winner, and Davey Hay sacked.
Just I'm just looking at the comparables of a manager that everybody said is too nice to be a really successful manager in charge, and the Celtic board taking the attitude of we know that we're in a far superior position to everybody else, and we'll just stick to our guns with our strategy, for a board who'd all been there too long.
Well, history repeats itself, doesn't it?
Hopefully not. Hopefully Rangers aren't going to appoint a manager that I can't stand.
Football is cyclical. Football is cyclical. Well, that's right. I mean, it was, you know, as soon as what he certainly made his mark early doors.
So that's the book. But you've also been around Celtic in other momentous times at the club, because you were at Celtic when Fergus was there.
Yeah. I came back from working abroad for 2 years, and I knew Peter McLean, who was a PR man at the time. And Peter was involved in marathons. He was a World Marathon Association or something of that ilk, and he'd been out where I'd been working in Thailand, and we tried to meet up for a pint a couple of times. It didn't quite happen, but I came back and I was doing some sub-editing shifts with the Scotsman, and I phoned him up and said, "Look, if you have any jobs going, you've got your ear to the ground, I'd appreciate your help." He said, "Well," he phoned me back a week later and said, "Well, there's a job at the Celtic View," and I'll be honest with you, I didn't fancy club media at all. You know, I don't think this has ever changed. I don't mean to disparage it at all. It does have a valuable job for the clubs, I'm sure. But Celtic View had an image of Pravda, let's be honest.
Well, it was really bad at that time for Al Pacino with a Celtic top, and Al Pacino's been a lifelong long Celtic fan.
Oh, yeah, dogs and sunglasses and Celtic tops on and so on. But I needed a job.
Wasn't much else to write about that time.
Well, actually, when I say it, this was March 1998, the Wim Jansen season was coming to end. In February, actually. It was coming to a head, so it was an interesting time to go. And I'll be honest, I was pretty much overawed. There was a lot of strong characters in the dressing room. You had guys like Craig Burley, Alan Stubbs, Tommy Johnson, Paul Lambert. Strong individuals, and it was quite intimidating, you know. And I always think back to it, I barely said booty a goose, really. But my first trip, if you like, foreign trip, it was really thrown in at the deep end. It was the day after Celtic stopped Rangers winning 10 in a row. And he went to Lisbon to play Sporting Lisbon and get a friendly game. And that's where Wim Jansen resigned, if you remember.
That's right, yeah. That's, people who can't see this, I'm going back in my seat, because as the minute you start saying that, I'm thinking that's a really momentous day.
Well, it is, yeah. I mean, it was a lot of tension around the club at that time. And it was a weird time to start a new job, because there was a lot of tension in the corridors, and people were really worried about whether they were going to do it or not. There was a great doubt. You know, maybe you remember, they got to Dunfermline and won a chance to do it.
I remember it well. Listening to the podcast will know, I got married the day before and went on my honeymoon 2 days later, so I could see Celtic win the league against Dunfermline.
That worked out well. what could possibly go wrong? Yeah, so they just sat deeper and deeper at St. Park that day. And then they do it, they go to Lisbon the next day, and the squad all turn up at the airport, as you can imagine, in a worse state of wear. And we went over there, and I didn't really have a relationship with Wim Jansen, A, because I was new, and B, because Wim Jansen, to my perception anyway, was deeply suspicious of the Celtic View, because he didn't really speak to the backroom coaches, Willie McStay, Eric Black. And he didn't particularly have much time for Celtic View, because he perceived all of us to be Jock Brown's people. So obviously he wasn't speaking to Jock Brown. He did Tony Hamilton's club call, actually. Tony's come a long way since then. did Tony Hamilton's club call, where he gave the first sign that actually he might not be long for this world. It was an open secret at the time, anyway. He didn't speak to Jock Brown. And Jock Brown had a call in the Celtic View, Jock Talk. And therefore Wim Jansen. I always remember the press conference he gave over in Lisbon. It was the Estoril Hotel, Palazzo Hotel, where Celtic stayed when they won the European Cup. They stayed in this marble-lined palace. And I remember giving the press conference, I remember all the daily newspaper guys being there, and they said, "What is Celtic View and you designing?" And they said, "Celtic View, if you want the Celtic View, ask him." And he pointed at me in a very disparaging way, and I thought, I just wanted to sink into the ground, you know. And I found out about that in a funny kind of way, because I was upstairs in my room, and I came downstairs to try and get some material. And the late Phil O'Donnell was sitting about, and I said, "Well, I'll corner Phil O'Donnell and ask him for an interview." And all the players were milling around. And Phil O'Donnell would for a 15-minute interview about the next season and about winning the league, without mentioning to me that Wim Jansen just resigned. So I finished this quite happy, you know, got another one in the bag for the magazine. And Jonathan Gould runs up and says, do you know what's happened? I said, Jim's just resigned. I said, oh, fuck. So you're in an awkward position because the guys at Paul Lambert coming up to me desperate to get their view over it. They were deeply disillusioned about Wim Jansen's departure.
Mm-hmm.
Paul was very close to him and wanted to spill his heart out to me about how Celtic board had made a terrible mistake. Well, that's fine, but it's a Celtic view.
Yeah.
And that's where you're put in a very invidious kind of Pravda-like position, because I wrote these pieces and I wrote it, I just reported it straight. But you can't blame the Celtic board for not wanting that to appear.
No, it's the club's...
Yeah, the clue is in the name. I was very young and naive and stupid, and you know, so obviously that stuff had to be rewritten extensively because it's a club organ. And I think people who are disparaging have to remember that. The clue is in the name. Whether it's the Celtic view or the Rangers news, the club set that up at their own expense to do their bidding for them. You can't be surprised when that's precisely what they do.
Yeah.
That's the way it is.
So, one of the things that's always got me about Wim Jansen, I remember we played Ajax, or a couple of games, but I remember particularly we played Ajax under Martin O'Neill, we won 3-1, and Wim getting a hero's reception. I've always been suspicious of a guy who leaves us after one season and never manages another football team again. Yeah. Why do you think he'd never...
I don't know. I found Wim Jansen an enigma. You know, some like Tony had a great relationship with him and get close. And I wasn't really there that long. I was a new boy. If I told you I knew Wim Jansen, I'd be lying. I only had two conversations with him. I did one programme preview at the time I was there. I found him an absolute enigma. And you know, the people who were better to me were guys like Eric Black and Willie McStay, the under-21 development team coaches, mm-hmm. who took a lot of time. Kenny McDowell was there as well. And they took a lot of time to really help you. And, I don't think there was much of a relationship with Wim Jansen. So you naturally kind of levitate towards people who are good to you.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm honest, I never really developed much of an attachment to Wim Jansen at all.
How did you find Dr. Joe?
Oh, he was a lovely guy. Dr. Joe was a lovely guy. Was he past his peak as a coach? Of course he was. I think people often forget Dr. Joe was the coach of Sporting Lisbon the night Celtic beat them 5-0 in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he faced protests from Sporting Lisbon fans that night when he got back. And a lot of time had passed by the time he got to Celtic. And he was a lovely, lovely guy, but he was the wrong guy in the wrong movie. I always remember it was a terrible summer because there was a lot of speculation about who would be the manager. And Joe Brown would walk past the desk.
So yeah, that's a good question, actually, because you were in Celtic when there was speculation about a manager and you might have an insight into how a football club behaves in that environment.
My theory is that people always think the board know what they're doing. I'm less convinced. They'll have plans, they'll have ideas, they'll have people in mind. I don't think the process is so different for the process fans go through. Mm-hmm. I remember Joe Brown would go up and down the corridor every day during that long, weedy summer of speculation. Remember Egil Olsen was linked with it?
Yep.
But didn't want to move because he didn't want to put his dog in quarantine or something. That was a lucky escape. But, I mean, imagine having a Norwegian manager. Would that just be...
Who would do such a thing?
So Egil Olsen could have been the first Norwegian manager. Didn't take it. There was obviously the Hugh went with the Arthur Hoggy thing. But nobody really knew, and I don't think Celtic board knew either. They seemed to help Benton getting some kind of footballing intellectual in. But I would look at Joe Baroon every day. He would walk up the corridor and I'd look at him with big eyes saying, is this a day? He'd just shake his head. And you knew there wasn't going to be a Celtic manager that day. So we got to a Friday afternoon, close to the start of the season. And it became clear Celtic had their man. But nobody knew who it was. It took a great perverse pride in making sure nobody, this news didn't get out. And Hugh ran with the Arthur Hoggy story, which it'll be carved in his gravestone, I'm sure he would admit.
There's a lot, just on that, because you work in the industry, there's a lot of conspiracy theories that he was deliberately fed the wrong, or either he was deliberately fed the wrong story to make him look stupid, or there was a deliberate leak went out to find out who was leaking stories, and that's how Hugh got caught.
That's not beyond the realms of possibility. I don't know, I've never asked you about it, never spoken to him about it. Not beyond the realms of possibility. Celtic have always enjoyed a bit of that. Letting deliberate misinformation get out to spite the SMSM. So that's the way it goes. But that Friday afternoon came, and they called a press conference in the boardroom, and still nobody knew.
So you didn't know as the in-house journalist of the club?
The first time I became aware, Kay Donaghy, who was Fergus McCann's PA, was walking up the corridor. And I said, come on, Kay, half an hour at the press conference, surely you can tell us who the manager is now. She said, I can't, but I'll tell you he's Czech. She said Czech, not me. And I said, oh, for goodness sake, it's not Joe Venglos, is it? And she just went white. And of course, at that time, people knew Joe Venglos as being a failed Aston Villa manager.
Yeah.
So I went to a press conference, and it was like being in a funny old movie, you know. And you know, I remember going when the John Barnes season, dream team season began. We went to Kongsvinger in Norway in a pre-season, and I remember sitting around a table with two or three senior players. I won't name them, and they were affectionately disparaging a Dr. Joe in terms of his team talks and the kind of team talks he gave, which basically weren't fit for purpose. In the middle of games against Rangers, you know, it would be all this kind of sportive combinations type stuff. And I don't know how much of that was language based. I don't know how much of it was that he was just the wrong man in the wrong job. But the one thing you will say is he made some amazing signings.
Yeah.
He signed Mark Viduka.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever you think of him, great player. He signed Johan Mjalby.
Yeah.
And he signed Lubomir Moravcik. He also signed Vida Rusev, but we won't go into that. He signed Lubomir Moravcik for £150,000. And you can never take that away from him. And he had a 5-1 win over Rangers as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I think they lost the cup final to Rod Wallace goal against Rangers at Hampden, 1999. And someone said to me before the game, there was a kind of reception for staff at Celtic Park before going to Hampden, and one of the executives said to me, tipped me a wink, he said, he won't be here next season. So the cycle goes on.
And that's where sometimes I think Celtic can be bad, in that there was a skill set that Dr. Joe had.
Yeah.
But it wasn't necessarily being first team coach.
Mm.
So instead of identifying in the course of the process, well, he's not quite first team coach material, but we should have him part of our club.
Well, there's a story about that as well, because when Kenny Dalglish and John Barnes came in those days, the Celtic View, you like to have something approaching a news story in page two, mm-hmm. just open the cover, and something a bit more feisty than the usual stuff. But we didn't have anything. It was 4:30 on a Monday afternoon, and I was walking back up from the football department, back up the stairs to the executive offices, the admin offices, and Kenny Dalglish comes down the stairs and says, "All right, wee man," as he did. I said, "Ah, okay, Kenny, but you know, we were scrambling about for something for page two for the viewers, getting near deadline and panicking a bit." He said, "Right, okay, phone me in 20 minutes. I'm going in the car, phone me in 20 minutes. So I'll phone him. And sure enough, he says, "Right, Dr. Joseph Venglos is going to be our European scout, Central European scout. We're looking at maybe setting up an academy over there, and he is going to find his players, the new Lubomir Moravcik."
Right.
"In Slovakia, Czech Republic, Austria, Central Europe."
Mm-hmm.
Utter nonsense, obviously. You know, I mean, I don't think it ever came to anything. But it was an interesting other side to Dalglish. I mean, you know, people have this image of holding press conferences in pubs and being a director of golf and so on. But, you know, one of the best days of that job was sitting in Kongsvinger, Norway, listening to him and Danny McGrain just shooting the breeze around a swimming pool. I mean, you can't buy that kind of experience, can you?
Yeah.
And he gave us a story about Dr. Joe Venglos and helped us out. And they were trying to preserve Dr. Joe's dignity, I think,
yeah.
apart to some degree, which is commendable, you know.
So when did you leave Celtic?
I left 4 or 5 months into the John Barnes season.
So you missed the...
Yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, famously John Barnes got off to a flyer and started his Celtic-based record since Jock Steen. And
yeah, I think it was 9 or 10 games, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah,
something like that. They thrashed Aberdeen 6-0 at Pittodrie, I think,
yeah.
and so on. I mean, the key night really was Leon.
Uh-huh.
I remember being on the flight that night coming back in the sight of Henrik Larsson at the front of the plane on row one, stretched across 3 seats, lying down with a plaster on his leg. And everyone else got off the plane before they moved them. And I remember coming right for the back of the plane when the media were, and almost being embarrassed to look, just glancing down at an utterly prostrate, helpless Henrik Larsson with a badly broken leg, and thinking, oh, dear goodness, it was a bad one. You knew it was a bad one. And that is often forgotten during the whole John Barnes thing. He was the best player at the club at a really key juncture.
I mean, I'm not saying John Barnes. I often think media coverage exacerbates this issue of, and I'm not being critical of media, I'm being understanding of the role that once they smell blood at one of Celtic or Rangers in particular, because they're the big clubs, then that's the story that you keep going after. It's an ever expanding role of negativity.
Yeah.
So that if I'm a fan and I only go to home games, and Celtic have played a cup game away from home, an international break, then had a league fixture away from home, so I'm going to the first game at Celtic Park for 4 weeks, but for 4 weeks I've been getting told every day the team's garbage.
Yeah.
15 minutes into the game when somebody has a slack pass, I've been told for 4 weeks the team's garbage, I'm more likely to get on that player's back.
Well, but thinking about this actually, I mean, I don't know, it's a bit of a kind of chicken and egg scenario, because I mean, some Celtic fans think the media have had it in for Ronnie Dyla. I mean, actually, I think the opposite is the case almost, because the media love Ronnie Dyla, because Ronnie Dyla speaks in headlines and he's a lovely guy. But when Celtic fans boo at the end of games, the media kind of take their lead from that to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether, it's an interesting point you make, I don't know whether the fans take their lead from the media or whether the media takes their lead from the fans.
I think it's a bit of both.
Yeah.
One feeds off the other and
Absolutely.
It just continues this. And that's where I think by Christmas time this season, I thought Ronnie Dyla's problem is he's in that massive downward spiral of when you're at a big club and that negativity.
I compare it to a dripping tap where once it starts, it's very hard to stop it.
And his big problem is if you're out of Europe, he doesn't have the ability to thump Rangers to take him back up.
No. Well, that's it. Absolutely. I mean, he's been judged against a kind of false prospectus in a really bizarre scenario. He's the first Celtic manager ever who hasn't had the boost of two wins a season against Rangers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he could always lose all the games, of course.
Yeah.
But that does an awful lot for a Celtic manager.
Uh-huh.
It can save his job. And he's not had the opportunity to do that.
I'm not saying it would have saved his job, but if it hadn't been quite as negative by the time we played Rangers and we'd have beaten Rangers 5-0 at Hampden.
Yeah. Well, it's a truly unique scenario. A truly unique scenario with being judged on Europe because of the perception, rightly or wrongly, and fair play to Aberdeen for trying, but I don't think anyone necessarily ever thought it was a truly concerted, serious challenge.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quickly decided that he's judged on Europe because that's the only place that he could, because there is, rightly or wrongly, there's this idea that a chimpanzee could win the league managing Celtic. I don't endorse that view, but it's what people think subconsciously. So he has to do it in Europe. And you know what, we can talk about whether it's the media, whether it's the fans, who it is that sparks the negativity. But the negativity, as I discovered when I worked there, the whole tone, the whole narrative of a football club comes from results on the football pitch. And if you don't get them, it influences and colours everything.
But that's where I would also criticise Celtic, because I don't think they've done very well at trying to combat the negativity in the last 18 months, 2 years. Their PR appears to be non-existent.
Well, I mean,
You talked about Pravda. They could have got some, in inverted commas, cheap hits by wholly backing the Res 12 position, for example.
Mm.
Now, might have had criticism from other quarters, but it would have certainly bought them positivity from the supporters.
Surprised by the AGM that they didn't do something along those lines. I thought they would pull some a rabbit out of the hat in terms of a, you know, we are seeking clarification on some Rangers matter or other.
Yeah.
You know, or the old John Reid trick of a couple of jibes at the other day. Was it the Holy Willie's jibe, was it? You know, I was surprised they didn't do that. The kind of default position to combat negativity is to ban journalists. There's been a couple banned.
I think that's silly.
I think it's counterproductive because, you know,
no matter how much that one journalist in particular gets him a go.
Yeah, but it's an abuse of power.
Yeah.
It's an abuse of power. And I can understand it's a kind of knee-jerk reaction to say, right, oh, is that... Because football clubs do hold the power. They hold all the aces. Celtic and Peter Lawwell are pretty powerful in the overall scheme. I think this is overlooked by Celtic sometimes. You know, they talk about, you know, this perception that Rangers are the established club, this and that. Actually, you know, Celtic have a man in charge who has immense power over the game in Scotland, and he also has the ability to make a journalist's life difficult and negate his currency by banning him from Celtic. Or, to put it in the fashionable phrase, withdrawing press facilities.
So I'm conscious of your time. So quick questions, two quick questions. First one is, how do people get their hands on your book?
It's an e-book. I mean, I only had the idea in November to do it.
Right.
Actually, it hinged on whether I could get Albert Kidd or not, because he's in Australia, I wasn't sure. But a great man came over to go to a game at Dundee, and I had 45 minutes of him. So then I thought, well, I'm going to do this. But by then, the whole publishing process of a print publisher takes 6 months. So it was going to be, it was just to sell it, to flog it, and also having published conventional books before, deeply disillusioned with the process, I thought, I'm going to do an electronic book, I'm going to try it. So it's on Kindle, £2.49, hardly a king's ransom.
Yeah.
It's available on Kindle, it's available on all our ebook platforms as well, so...
You should do an audio version. I love audio books that I can do them walking the dog.
Really?
Walk the dog and driving the car.
Interesting.
I don't get time to myself, honestly.
Interesting.
That's how I get books now, is I listen to them online.
I looked at it last week and I thought about it. I might well take you up on that idea.
There's a few books I've got.
I'll get Hugh Keevans to read it.
yeah, with a forward by Joe Brown and Michael Kelly. And yeah, get all the Celtic fans on board. And then the other question is, since you're in the Scottish mainstream media and know everything, when is Celtic appointing Davy Moyes? You don't think? You're not sure about Davy Moyes? Or whether it will be Davy Moyes?
I'm not. I don't. Well, put it this way, I am less cynical about it than others, though. I mean, I got a steer from...
Have they even sacked Martinez yet, or is that just this rumour?
Oh, that's a good question. It was a rumour going about social media last night. There's a number of things here. I was lucky enough to get a steer on David Moyes' thoughts in March, beginning of March, which basically went, he has an affection and affiliation with Celtic, he likes the club, his fond memories are playing there, high regard for him, but he's not sure about the Scottish League. Mm-hmm. And worried it would be a backward step, not quite sure how it would impact on his career, but hasn't ruled it out and won't rule it out because he wants to see what his options are in the summer. I think this has been reported a number of times. He would like the Everton job back. I don't think it's certain he'll get the Everton job. In fact, I'm not. He would have expected to be quoted for Newcastle, wasn't quoted for that. Not certain he'll get Everton back because they have a new investor who might want to do something completely
different.
I can't
see him getting the Everton job.
No, I can well understand that. The question would be, if Everton appoints, say, Eddie Howe, would he want to go to Bournemouth? Or if there's a kind of concertina effect, what comes up or what falls for him? But I don't rule out David Moyes at all, really. I just wonder whether something will come for him that will be better than what Celtic are offering. And the same applies to Brendan Rodgers, although I do think Brendan Rodgers has a self-conceit and an ego which would regard Scottish football as a backward retrospective step.
The one interesting point that was made on the Radio Scotland thing you were on last week that I thought was an interesting point about Moyes. People, the few Celtic fans that I've seen online who are not sure about Moyes, it's because he's not won anything.
Yeah.
Turn that on its head, he becomes Celtic manager and he wins.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And he has a crack. He does have a crack at the Champions League, because this is only a personal opinion. Sorry if it upsets people, but to my mind, you can improve that Celtic squad 30 or 40% just by walking through the door. Really? I mean, maybe the percentage is too high. But I think if you look at all the mistakes made against Rangers, so many of them emanated from the manager. The team selection, the formation, the reluctance, the loyalty to guys like Stefan Johansson, leaving it so long to replace them, suggestions that the team didn't look fit enough.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things can be tackled by a manager without spending £20 million. And you can make the team better instantly. So, are Celtic as bad as they look at them? And I'm not convinced they are, actually. And I think a new manager, be it Davy Moyes or an organised coach, you know, even if you throw the fans on Alec Neil or a Roy Keane, there's a status and a name there which I think might swing it. What I'm not sure about is how willing people are to turn the clock back to Neil Lennon or... You know what,
I would be exceptionally disappointed if we went for Neil Lennon. Nothing personal against Neil Lennon, but it's two things. I think a lot of fans are looking at rose-tinted spectacles and forgetting how annoyed we were getting knocked out of the cup by Aberdeen and Morton.
Well, things weren't about a bundle of roses at the end, were they?
And secondly, I just think going backwards. He may have learned a lot being at Bolton, but I just think it's a step backwards to go for Lennon.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, as I say, it wasn't exactly a bundle of roses at the end, and I think there's an inevitability that Neil Lennon will be back at Celtic one day. Whether it will be with the current regime in place, I'm less convinced. But if you were looking at it now, you would say he is their insurance policy. He is their backup if they can't get any of the people they're really going to.
From what my perception is, I think, getting back to the PR aspect of it, I think they should be breaking their necks to a point within 24 hours of the trophy being lifted.
Yeah, well, I mean, Dermot Desmond is a place, Sandy Lane in Barbados. He should get David Moyes and Brendan Rodgers over there and ply them with rum cocktails until they say yes.
And my issue with Keane, if that's a preference of Dermot Desmond, is that if Keane came in, he'd be coming in 5 minutes before we played Champions League football.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think people have this image of Keane starting to fight in an empty room. He could be a divisive figure. He could be great box office. He would get people interested in Celtic down south and beyond again. He's got that benefit. And if I was really pushed, I would say I still think Roy Keane is a lightweight guy to do it, to take the job. Because in my mind, I think Peter Lowell's two choices are Rodgers and Moyes. Ambitious, I think even Peter Lowell accepts that they don't choose these guys choose Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
So you're up against it right away. But I think if you're talking about Dermot Desmond's list, then Dermot Desmond likes an Irish presence at Celtic. We've seen that down the years. I don't think that's a particularly controversial statement, because I think he feels there is an affiliation to Ireland and Celtic that should be preserved at all costs. And I think there's also some evidence that the number of Irish fans going to games has fallen.
Yeah.
Would Roy Keane tackle that? I don't know. But I think that'll be in their mind.
Okay, well, we shall come back to that. And Stephen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that podcast, Trip Down Memory Lane, for two periods, and then on to the discussion about the current Celtic manager's position. There are still just a handful of places available at the Celtic FC Foundation's celebration of the 30th anniversary of that momentous league championship winning event. Various guests from the Celtic side, including Mr. Albert Kidd, Dundee player and Celtic fan, has come over from Australia to be at the event. So an excellent event, and all for the good cause of the Celtic FC Foundation. If you want to go along, log on to the Celtic FC Foundation website and see how you can go and get tickets. You can go on to Amazon and search for Heartbreakers, Celtic, Albert Kidd and 1986. The author is Stephen McGowan, that's with a PH and MC. It's £2.49 from Kindle. That was Stephen McGowan talking about all things Celtic. This is me, Harry Brady, saying goodnight and God bless. Good night.